everyone in this room and everyone in other rooms. It's Friday night again here in Paris. I've been thinking for the past few days about something that I read in a book. I just read a sort of biography of the French psychoanalyst, children's psychoanalyst, Françoise Dolto. And she was asked on a... She had written a book, this was in the late 70s. She had written a book about... She had read the... Les Évangiles, how do you say that in English? The Gospels. And she had written a book in the French. The title was L'Évangile au risque de la psychanalyse. And it was a book about the Gospels and psychoanalysis and how she read the Gospels and how that applied to how she saw the interaction of the two, whatever. So she was invited to a very famous French literary talk show, Apostrophe. And with some other, it was a Good Friday, and so there were other Christian-type books that were authors of Christian books who were on the show as well. And they were all men except her. And she was the last one to be interviewed and to speak, and the interviewer asked her if she was Christian. And she said, well, I was baptized. And at this time, she was probably, I think, 70 years old, maybe even older. And he said, are you practicing? In French, you would say pratiquante. And she said, well, I do my best. And he said, well, that's quite unorthodox for a psychoanalyst, no? And she said, well, I envy atheists because they have a certainty. They are sure. They're certain about something. She said, I envy them because me, I have no certainties. And I loved this response. Not particularly to have to do with Christianity or psychoanalysis or atheism, but about life. And this practice, as we say, it's about not knowing, about having no certainties. Every moment is new, and we never know what it entails. We don't even know who we are or who the other is. Everything is mysterious in that sense. And this what Françoise Dolto said goes much beyond that. I'm just kind of summarizing it in a nutshell. But I think probably it applied to her practice as a psychoanalyst as well. She had no certainties when she was listening to someone. She's famous for working with babies, like newborns, and with children under 3 years old who didn't have a lot of language to communicate with. And I heard another psychoanalyst, recent, contemporary psychoanalyst, say of her, some people speak Spanish, some people speak Arabic, some people learn Portuguese. Françoise Dolto spoke child, the language of children. And in that was a great letting go, a renouncing of everything you think you know, everything you're like projecting onto the baby while it's crying, and everything you, all the certainties that you have. In a sense that it's harder to be certain with a baby or a small child than it is with an adult, because we have all these certainties about adults, and we know so much, and we know language, and we know what they're saying, and we have our idea about it. Whereas with a baby, it's different. So I think that this notion of certainty applied to her practice as a psychoanalyst. For me, it applies to this practice of ours, of Zen, and as well to every moment, which is my practice. So it applies to life and practice, which are one for me. Because if I come to each moment without a certainty of that moment, then I can really experience it. I can really be with whatever arises. In another book that I recently read, which I have here, just because I wasn't sure if I would get the quotes right, but by a friend, an American Zen teacher who was coming to speak here actually in April, Tim Burkett. This is his second book, and it's called Zen in the Age of Anxiety. And he gives this story of two disciples of a rabbi. And they were having an argument. One of the disciples said, the practice, everything that we do in this practice with this rabbi is about effort, discipline, perseverance, work. The other disciple was saying, no, it's about letting go, surrendering, giving up, renouncing, just being with what is. So they went to see the rabbi. And the first one told the rabbi what his position was: work, discipline, dedication, effort. The other one gave his, and the rabbi said, you're right. And the next one gave his position about giving up, surrendering, letting go, just being with what is, no effort. And the rabbi said, you're right. And there was a third disciple who was listening to this conversation, and he said, but rabbi, they can't both be right. And the rabbi said, you're right. What a wonderful opening to everything that is. One thing doesn't discount another. And in fact, there is no right or wrong in this approach to the rabbi's approach. That yes, this is something that comes up all the time with people when they talk to me about their meditation practice. It's, you talk about letting go of just, not grasping things, of no effort, not having a goal. And yet, if I don't have a goal, if I don't make some effort, then I won't even be sitting here. And I'm saying, yeah, you're right. And at the same time, if someone comes in and says to me, oh, I have to work so hard, I have to just keep doing this, I have to keep at it, and I'm really working so hard at this, and nothing's happening, and I want to give up, and I'm like, you're right. At the same time as you have to make effort, you also have to give up the effort at some point. And at some point you have to make effort. These are two seemingly opposite aspects of life. We can reduce it to what we call difference and diversity and oneness and unity. So no effort is just, it's all good. There's no difference. Effort is the equivalent of doing this and doing this and doing this and doing this and seeing the differences and when I'm working and when I'm not working and when I'm counting my breath and when I'm not counting my breath and when I'm drifting and when I'm not drifting and I'm going away and I'm coming back. They're both necessary. It's like one foot or the other foot. They're both necessary. And at some point, over and over and over again, we make the effort to sit, breathe in, breathe out, drift off, come back. Over and over and over and over again, we do this. It can take a long time. It can take days and days and days. It can take years and years and years. Months and months and months. But little by little, we become familiar with this just coming back and things as they are. And that the going away is also things as they are. That it's not only the coming back and just being here now that is, it's also the going away that's part of what is here now. As I sat here in my meditation tonight, before this talk, my mind was very scattered. I had a busy day, thinking about this or that, or thinking, oh, I have a headache, or I'm tired, or I have to do this, or I have to do that. What will I do tomorrow? What am I going to talk about? How will the Facebook Live work? A million things in my mind. And I just sat down, and breathed. And as the more that I did that, sometimes I closed my eyes, sometimes I opened them. But even when I opened them, I still kept my gaze towards the ground. And I came to notice that with the in-breath, the inhale was the equivalent of like activity, of doing, or something like that. The effort. And the out-breath was like letting go. The no effort, dropping it, surrendering, renouncing. And then there would be an in-breath. And it started again. The active, the doing, the moving. And then I And there was something so freeing in that. And kind of the, whatever the cares, the thoughts, the projections, the attachments, whatever the previous thought had been, whatever the anticipating the next thought or the next breath or something, dropped away. And I found myself becoming settled. Now, this is not the first time that I've experienced this. I've been doing this for a long time. But it was the first time. At the same time, it's not the first time, and it is the first time. I saw a poem by Emily Dickinson recently. Or I'm not sure if it was from another poem or if it was the entire poem. But it said... And the first line was, it was three lines. Forever is composed of nows. Well, that's it. You know, there's this very singular, unique now. And yet, that now is endless. So, it's at once singular, unique, and yet if we try to find where it starts and ends, we can't. So it's like with the breathing. So I am saying with the in-breath, I was being active, and with the out-breath, I was letting go. But in fact, there is no separation between the in and the out. And yet, there is. We recognize this as something very different. And yet, if we try to find where the beginning and the end is, we can't really find it. This week I was preparing a writing workshop, a week-long writing and meditation workshop that I will be leading in a few weeks. And like with this sitting down and experiencing this letting go and this liberating feeling of in and out, I've done this writing workshop before. I've done a lot of writing workshops in the past 20 years. I've led a lot and I've participated in a lot. But I try to each time sit down and look at it and see, okay, what will I do now? What will I do this time? And I try to keep in mind, even though I don't know who will be there, try to tell myself, make it new for the people. Maybe there's someone who's already done this writing workshop with me. How can I make it new? Not necessarily changing it, but making it new. So I look back over everything and see how I feel about it, and maybe there's a different exercise or something. And again, in this book by Tim Burkett, I came across a writing exercise that he proposes, which applies again to what I'm talking about. He suggests, and I think I will tailor it a little differently for my students in the workshop that I do, but he suggests doing this exercise at the end of the day, maybe before you go to bed or something. And so he says, look back over your day and make a note of everything you did. You know, it can be very detailed. I watched television, I watched such and such a series, I had pasta for dinner with tomatoes and artichokes and olive oil, and I talked to my friend on the telephone. We made plans to go to the beach in June, or I don't know, whatever it is, details. And then he says, while you're doing this, you can ask yourself three questions. One, what surprised me today? And that can help you then. So then you can look back and say, oh, this surprised me. This surprised me today. For me, what surprised me today, if I look at that, was I received a text message from a friend who I haven't talked to since before the summer. And then last night, before I went to bed, I thought, I'm going to send her a text message tomorrow. And when I got up this morning, there was a text message from her. Surprised. The second thing he says is ask yourself, what touched me today? Look back on your day and see, was there something that touched me? And so I thought, okay, so what touched me today? And the first thing that came to mind was I did in the garden tonight before I came here with my husband a ceremony for our cat who died 8 weeks ago today. And we've been, for the first week, we did it every day. This is a traditional Buddhist schema of ritual after a death. Every day for 7 days after the death. And then, every 7 days for 7 weeks. So every Friday for 7 weeks we've done it. So this is the seventh Friday. And even when we weren't together, I did it on my own. Even if there was no one else with me, I did it, the world ceremony. Wherever I was in Chicago when I did it twice. And I was in Memphis once. What touched me, it touches me every time I do it, is when I chant, because I act as the chant leader in the ceremony. I chant, it's a dedication that we make to Something may the benefits of this, incense, candle, and flower benefit all beings, the peace in the world, all members, family of the Sangha members, and particularly to, and you say, the being or person who has died. So every time I come to that, and I have to say, and especially to Sati, who décédé le 27 juillet, whatever, it gets me. It doesn't right now when I'm saying it, because I'm not in the same posture as when it's the ceremony. But it touches me now, but not in the same way that it does when I'm doing it. And the garden touches me. It was her garden. That was where she lived, basically. Of course, she lived in her house, but her favorite thing to do was be outside in the garden. And she spent most of her days out there. And she loved it when we would come out in the garden, too. She was very sociable, and if we had dinner party in the garden, she was there. Partly because there was food, but also because she just liked to be with people. You know, she was a very sociable cat. When sometimes we did meditation at my house, and she would come and sit with us. You remember? Yeah. She would come and she would sleep on someone's cushion next to us, or on my lap or something. And so today it was touching for me to go into the garden and do the ceremony and to say her name and when she died. And know that it was the last one that we will do for a year, because it's the tradition is so every day for 7 days, every 7 days for 7 weeks, and then every year. Now, if I feel like it, I will do it other times, but that touched me. Among other things that touched me today, but that was one thing. And then the third question, Tim says, is, what inspired me today? So as I was sitting here tonight, and I stayed with that question, what inspired me today? I didn't know that I was going to talk about this necessarily, but I was staying with those questions that I read. And what came to me was, the people who are here inspire me. The people come and want to share this practice, and here, meaning also the people who maybe are listening somewhere else, people in this room, as I said, but everyone, everywhere inspires me in some way, particularly the people with whom I directly share the practice. And it's a constant inspiration for me. I could also say I listened to a podcast by a poet, what's her name? Suddenly I've forgotten her name. Naomi Nahib Ride, does that ring a bell to anyone? No. Anyway. And she, among many things that she said, my life is a poem. Your life is a poem. And I found that really inspiring, as a poet, particularly. But because I feel the same way, but I had never phrased it in that way. But also in terms of how that relates to this practice, you know, my Dharma name is Tu es cela, you are that. It's not I am that, it's you are that, so it's you. It's also me, but it's you. And you are that. You are the poem, you know? I have a poem that's called The Whole Story, and it ends with, you are the whole story in all of the parts. That inspires me. So, this is an amazing three questions that Tim puts to us and suggests as a writing exercise. He suggests it as a practice for a week. Just sit down 10 minutes per day, do this. I will integrate it into my writing workshop as a daily practice as well, for people. I'm not sure how I'll present it, but I think I will introduce it. Because when we have a week like that, it's not like when we have a day or a day and a half of writing practice. It's a week, you know, you have time to spread out and deepen and rise. And this is a way of helping you do that. A practice like that, something you do every day. So, like Tim, I would also, you know, suggest, maybe not if you want to do a writing practice, sure, why not? I always recommend writing practices. However, these are three questions you can ask yourself just when you're walking down the street. What touches me right now? Does anything inspire me? What surprises me? You know, even while you're having your lunch, instead of, you know, we're always doing something else, right? We're reading the newspaper, or we're looking at the television, or we're listening to music, or doing work, or something else. You know, instead of doing that, maybe you could, while you're having lunch, say, what surprises me today? Or what surprised me last night, or something? Or in your meditation. It can be a meditation practice. What does it mean to be surprised? What does it mean to be touched? What does it mean to be inspired? So I think I would like to open it up to questions or comments or stories, poems, whatever anyone would like to share.
In the earlier part of your talk, you were speaking about, you know, okay, the sort of the story or parable of the disciple who said, it's about making effort, right? And the rabbi said, that's right. And the person said, no, it's about letting go. And he said, that's right. And the third person saying they were contradictory, that's also right. And it made me think of something that I think about a lot, which I can't quote very accurately, but I think some of you might recognize, and which also incidentally is Christian, like the psychologist, or at least her sort of flavor of believing, which is that famous Christian saying or quote, I don't even know where it's from, God grant me the power to let go of things that are not in my control, and the wisdom, maybe the wisdom to let go of things that are not within my control, the power to try to change the things that are within my control, and the wisdom to know the difference. It's something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you recognize or remember this. I think about that a lot. I think that there's so much truth in that idea, whether you subscribe specifically to the God part or to how maybe God was conceived of when that was written, but or not. But this idea of trying to impact what we can impact and let go of what we can let go of and recognize their difference, but also maybe do them both, and there could be a certain contradiction in that. And I find I was trying to give my father advice yesterday on the phone, and I find that oftentimes when I try to give advice to other people or to myself, that's basically the advice, is what is within your power. And do you want to change it? And can you change it? And what do you need to do to change it? And what is not within your power, and can you let go of it a little bit more? And can you, first of all, figure out the difference and accept and come to an acceptance of those things?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's something, isn't there something similar in the 12-step Alcoholics Anonymous thing?
Oh, maybe that's where it's from. I actually don't know.
I don't know if it's about God in the 12 steps, but I think there is one in the scene, like something like that.
Do you know where it comes from? Mm-hmm. But you recognize it?
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think it's very true, and it does relate with the two aspects. It also depends how we define control and changing and wisdom, you know, all of these things. And often that's where we stumble too in this practice, because we say, well, everything is always changing, everything is impermanent, and we there's this misunderstanding about non-attachment, about not being attached, just letting things be.
Mm-hmm.
That they're perfect as they are, so just let them be. And that would kind of be a one-legged wisdom of, I have no control over anything, so just leave it as it is. That would be to not have the wisdom to see what I could act upon, you know, as you say. There are things that I can act upon. Again, Tim tells a story that he was a disciple of Suzuki Roshi in the 60s in California. And he was having a terrible time with Orioki, you know, this way, this very complicated, elaborate, ceremonial way that we eat in Zendo. And he also had, like, these robes, and he was tripping over them, you know, getting in the way, and he was having a terrible time. And he went to see Suzuki Roshi and told him about this and how horrible it was, and he was complaining and everything. And Suzuki said, Tim, you're perfect just like you are. And this was an illumination for Tim. Wow, I'm perfect just the way I am. And he felt so free. And so this was in the morning, and the rest of the day he just went out walking, and this was at Tassajara, which is in this beautiful, fabulous place in the mountains in California, and in the wilderness, and he just spent the rest of the day out walking and hiking and wandering on the trails and swimming in the stream and whatever. And when that night when he came back, or later in the day, probably around dinner time, he came back and he was going to his cabin, and he came across Suzuki Roshi, who asked him to come and see him. So he came and he said, and Tim went on about how wonderful it was. He was free, he was perfect, everything was great just like it was. Suzuki said, yeah, Tim, that's true, but you still have some things to work on. And again, you know, it's like, so it's true. We don't have to do anything. You know, we can let go of things and it's perfect. At the same time, there's things to do, you know, and there's things we can do. I recommend Tim's books. He has two books, and they're full of stories like this about Suzuki Roshi, about his other, he's a teacher himself, so he doesn't give people's names, but, you know, he talks about people who he works with and, you know, his life experience, from, you know, his childhood through the 60s, because he was, you know, like in California in the 60s and everything. Anyway.
But so, then when, how do you know?
Ah, that's the key, huh? May I have the wisdom to know. Yeah.
Difference.
And that's where the sitting comes in. As I said, you know, over and over, we just keep letting go and coming back and letting go and coming back, you know, over and over and over and over again. And that's where the perseverance and the effort comes in. It's like not giving up, not giving in to, oh, I'm not good at this, or, you know, getting caught by the same frustrations, the same emotions, the same anger, same attachments, getting caught by that, and not getting stuck there. Just, okay, it's the same thing over again, you know, and just sit again, sit again, sit again, sit again. And over time, we come to see little glimmers, or we notice something different. You know, we notice, I'm doing that again, and yet I'm not caught up in it. And it's not about wanting, the wisdom is too, so then knowing I don't have to intervene there. I don't have to go in and figure out why I'm frustrated and get caught in, up in it, or the anger I'm feeling, and so why is it always that person I'm angry at, and looking into it. We don't have to do that. We can just be with it. Just sit and let it go and be there. And that's often where we get caught, is by we become frustrated with the same stuff happening all the time. So it'd be like if tonight I got caught by, I've done this so many times. My mind is so scattered on Friday night when I'm supposed to give a talk. I've had such a busy day. It used to be, too, when we were at the Red Earth Center and I was working, and I always worked on Fridays. And so I'd have a, you know, really busy, intense day Friday, and, you know, it was the bouclage, the deadline for the section I was working on in the newspaper, and it was hectic and crazy, and interactions with colleagues, and, you know, a reporter on the phone, and he wasn't doing what he was supposed to do, and all kinds of stuff. And then I had to take the metro, and I was, you know, super busy and crowded and problems in the metro and whatever. And then I had, came to the Red Earth Center, and I was supposed to give a talk. I was like, whoa. And I imposed that practice on myself. I could have said, no, I'm not going to give a talk on Friday night. I work, too busy, whatever. No, I'm not going to give a talk on Friday night. Or I'll do it once a month or something, you know. But no, I imposed that rhythm on myself. And through doing it and just being with it, I never knew what I was going to talk about, like tonight. I didn't really know. I had been reading these books, and so I had some stuff that was in my head, but I didn't know what I would talk about. And so whatever would come up is what I would talk about. Sometimes it was about some interaction I had on the train. Sometimes it was about something that happened at work. Sometimes it was about something I had read in the newspaper. So, or none of that. But I came to trust that whatever came up was okay. And I could just sit with it and let it be, and it was okay. Again and again and again. And so tonight, if I had come and I had said, oh, it's this again, you know, this crazy mind, this monkey mind that they call it, we call it in Buddhism. It's jumping all over the place again, and, you know, I have a pain in my leg or in my head or whatever. And I'm tired, and I have this stuff I have to do, and whatever. If I had been caught by that, I would not have been able to sit here and give a talk. Give a talk sounds like something grandiose. I'm just sitting here talking. I mean, it's just just sitting here telling you what's coming up in my mind as I'm sitting here. Which, you know, there was a time when that was really, really difficult for me. But doing it has become much easier. And I'm grateful to my teacher and her teacher for imposing this discipline of no preparation, no notes, not writing. You know, there are teachers, maybe some of you have seen them, who write the whole thing out and give the talk like reading the paper, or have the paper in front of them while they're doing it. Sometimes I make some notes, and sometimes not. And I might refer to them, but it always seems like I look at the notes and I'm kind of like, what? No. It's got to be what's here now. That's what I'm talking about. And so my teacher imposed that discipline on us, although I learned it because I saw her do it. And she, her teacher imposed that discipline on her. And she saw him do it. Are we losing the signal here? Is that the...
It's going on and off.
Okay. Just like everything.
Right? It must be hard for those listening, though.
Probably. I'm sorry. So voilà. So thank you, Nina, for saying that. And there's something very empowering about that, actually, about having the wisdom to know when I need or when it's appropriate to act and when it's not. And even what the action is, because that's also what is necessary in this moment, what's appropriate. And the only way we can know is to let go of our certitudes, our certainties. So we come back full circle to François Dolto. The only way we can do what's appropriate in any given moment is by it not knowing. You know, if I had this certainty that to repair the light fixture, I need a screwdriver. And actually, I don't need a screwdriver, but I need a wrench. And I only bring a screwdriver, well, I'm in trouble. And I will probably break the light fixture because I would need a wrench to fix it, not a screwdriver. I don't know how much time we have. I don't want to...
It's 9:25.
Okay, so we should probably stop.
Now the connection is low. I see two people. One just connected, though.
Oh. Well, I'm sorry if you just connected. we're about to wrap things up here.
I wonder what time you draw a book, you know?
I have no idea.
Because if it's Portugal, I don't know.
They didn't have the right time, yeah, maybe.
They're an hour different.
Well, it's available. These nows are available forever on Facebook. So you can go back to Facebook anytime and click on it, and it plays over and over and over again. I personally won't go look at it, but someone might. So, thank you.
Sorry, I didn't know how to do this. Why did this say this? Huh? Okay.
Good.
Voilà.
Voilà, merci.
I actually like Tinker.
Be some video for like
a life. It's done.
It was very appropriate, yeah.
Ding.
Cool.